Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. Thank you for joining me today, and I'm so glad you're here because there's a really important conversation we're going to be having today. I just want to say before I jump into that to, well, first of all, welcome anyone who may be listening for the very first time, and also to encourage you to go over to my Facebook page, which is What Women Must Know, and like me there because I post all of my podcast on my Facebook page, or you can go to my website, which is drcherylselman.com, and if you opt in there, then I send out those podcasts to you directly. So either way, you'll be able to get all of the shows and never have to miss a beat with any of them. And you really want to do that because I have some amazing guests and information that truly is life-changing, like my conversation today. So today we are talking to Justine Watson, who is calling in all the way from Bali. Lucky her. And we're going to be talking about a really important subject, and it's the untold dangers of mesh implant devices. And if you're not sure what mesh implant devices are, hang in there because you're going to learn more than you ever thought possible. And a little bit about Justine. Justine Watson was born in the UK and emigrated to Australia in 1992. Since qualifying as a counselor in 1998, Justine has maintained a private practice working with individuals and families on a wide range of issues. Justine is the president and co-founder of Mesh Injured Australia. She was just 40 years old when she decided to make an appointment with a specialist about her embarrassing secret, stress urinary incontinence. And Justine says it was her hope that the surgery would allow her to get back into an active lifestyle. However, she instead found herself plagued by mysterious, agonizing, and debilitating symptoms, all of which began to increase as the months progressed. And Justine said that she now has regained her quality of life, but recognizes that most mesh survivors are not this fortunate. And based in Sydney, she now works alongside professionals in the Royal Prince Alfred Hospital to provide consumer co-design to a multidisciplinary clinic for pelvic mesh implant victims. This is a really powerful story. I heard Justine being interviewed on a podcast in Australia that friends put on, and I was captivated and horrified, I have to say, by the story and what she went through, innocently thinking she was going to take care of a problem, and it turned into a nightmare. So out of that, she has become a powerful advocate for women and for all those that have been injured with these devices, and is truly making a huge difference in the world. So I'm just so thrilled to have this amazing woman with us today. So having said all that, I want to welcome Justine to the show today. Hello, Justine from Bali.
Hello from Bali. Thank you for such a beautiful, warm, and accurate welcome.
Well, you're so welcome. I'm so glad we're able to connect and have you tell the journey you've been on, because I know that it's a journey that many women have gone through, and you're just doing an amazing job in serving women and helping to really find a way out of the darkness that so women get into without even realizing it. So let's start with your story, Justine, because it's a powerful story, and when people understand just the consequences when we go through these procedures and not realizing what we're really embarking upon and how it can alter our life. So I'm going to let you just take off and begin with the journey that started this whole experience.
Thank you. Well, let me say I'm in my 10th year of this story, and it all started back in when I was turning 40. I went to Bali with my girlfriend on a 40th birthday girl extravaganza, which was quite unique because many of us were mothers of special needs children, which is another part of my story. And as I would fondly laugh about it, the tears used to run down my leg. And my girlfriends all kind of got together and went, look, sweetie, there is a surgery for this. And I was like, really? Is it really that important? Okay, you know, I've got bigger fish to fry right now, a mortgage to pay, kids to put through school, you know, special needs kids. You know, I'm pretty busy. And they said, no, you know, why don't you go and at least talk to them? So I went to the first surgeon and he gave me the 3% talk. And my stepfather was a surgeon, so I knew what the 3% talk was. You know, so you've got 3% of dying. You know, everyone's got 3%. There's a 3% risk, la, la, la. And I sort of walked away from there going, you know what, I live in the 3%. I had an Asperger father, a mother with narcissistic personality. I had 2 special needs kids. I was like, I live in the 3%. I'm not taking that risk. So my dear friend said to me, look, you know, we've got a surgeon and he has a profound autistic child and we think he'll really take care of you. So I went to see him as my second opinion, and he sort of abated all my fears. However, he didn't practice true and informed consent, which would have been, this device is permanently implanted in your vagina. This device is made of polypropylene, the same material as plastic chairs. This device is meant to be coated in scar tissue and cause inflammation in the body. And if this device was to go wrong, it will be like trying to extract a passion fruit vine from a chicken coop. So, you know, that's where the nightmare started, I guess, is I put my trust in this doctor because we had something in common. And he didn't practice informed consent. And I really didn't do my due diligence. I did not sit and make inquiries and use the means that I would have had and the intelligence that I had in order to do that, because I trusted him. And I trusted that the process, you know, was going to be normal. And it was at that time, I guess. I mean, I have heard from lawyers that it was around 2008, and this happened to me in 2010. It was around 2008 that there was some real serious concerns, you know, being raised with the TGA, the FDA, and so on. So, you know, they started to know back then that there were some serious problems, and they were still using it then, and they're still using the stress urinary incontinence implants in Australia today. So, you know, he told me it was a quick recovery time, I'd be back at work, I wouldn't be able to pick up my son for a little while, a few days, but really it was, you know, I was young, fit and healthy, nothing to worry about. And my embarrassing problem, which wasn't too embarrassing to me, but I can understand how it is for women, especially women with pelvic organ prolapse, that's incredibly uncomfortable. You know, and 50% of women suffer either stress urinary incontinence or pelvic organ prolapse after childbirth. So that's 1 in 2 women who are candidates for this surgery, which is why it's so important for these stories to be told. So, you know, in I went, I had the surgery and I came out, and the one thing that I do remember is when I came out of the hospital, was leaning on a car, feeling instantly nauseous and vomiting everywhere, and crawling back up my stairs at home in pain to go to bed after the surgery. And I remember the nurses just going, oh, you've just had surgery, you'll be fine. And I remember it was a very, very hot day in Sydney, and I remember just feeling absolutely, you know, in pain, unwell. You know, my body had obviously started reacting from the word go. Now, as we do as busy mothers, we absorb things in our lives, and I absorbed this. But what I noticed within 6 to 12 months was that my mental health had started to decline. I was more anxious than I'd ever been. I felt really unwell a lot of the time. My tiredness levels increased. And, you know, I kind of sat back and reflected and thought, well, you know, you are, you know, fulfilling a full private practice. You have a child with autism, a child with ADHD. You know, you have a lot of stuff going on, a big mortgage. And, you know, maybe you're just beginning to burn out. So life took some interesting turns and twists. And my husband at the time and myself decided we would move to Bali for a, you know, 6 to 12 month sort of rest sojourn. And that's what we did. However, you know, in that time, my health kind of stabilized, but I wasn't in great shape at all. And by 2013, I was in and out of hospitals in Bali regularly with recurrent infections, UTIs, chest infections, stomach infections. You know, I went as far as the London Tropical Disease Unit in 2016 because I was just terrified that I'd gotten myself a nasty disease in a tropical country, and that's what was killing me. So 2013, it was rounds of antibiotics in and out of hospital. By 2015, I couldn't get out of bed. The UTIs basically never left. I've never been a big fan of antibiotics, so I was very blessed to find a very educated and open-minded naturopath over here. And I entered into very high doses of vitamin C, magnesium, glutathione, etc. And I would have one of those every 2 weeks. And I started on a very, very strict regimen and protocol of a health routine. But of course, you know, a few months feeding me, which should have gotten me better from whatever we thought it was, and I was just getting sicker. So it was terrifying. I would go back to my GP in Sydney, who I'd known for years, and because he couldn't work out what was wrong with me, he then, you know, sent the message of, you need to see a psychiatrist, i.e. it's all in your head. And, mm-hmm. you know, I went everywhere. I went, flew back to Perth, flew back to Sydney, flew when my mother died in the UK in 2016. I looked there for answers, went to the London Tropical Diseases Unit. You know, like, I spent a lot of time, a lot of money and a lot of energy looking for answers, and I just had the door slammed in my face at every turn. It was like, you look fit and healthy, and yet I can't get out of bed and can't get my head off the pillow. So 2017 showed up, and my incontinence, the surgery never really worked, which is a really interesting thing. You know, it kind of worked for a few months, but then even in my reports of my follow-up from the surgery, the report was, I don't really understand why, but she's now leaking when she stands up, which I wasn't doing before. So my incontinence changed. Urge incontinence arrived, which is that key in the door incontinence, where you're like, oh my God, I've got to go and I've got to go right now. And really the surgery didn't actually change my incontinence, it just worsened it. So 2017 came, and as I say, my mum died and a whole bunch of other stuff happened, you know, life happened, and I was in bed for, you know, from 2015 pretty much on and off because I couldn't get my head off the pillow. And I had a diagnosis of fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, thyroid problems, you know, the list just went on. And so 2017 showed up and I went, this is silly. I'm going back to that surgeon. Everything is out of control in my life. I have no idea what is going on. And I was divinely led back to my original surgeon. And, you know, in hindsight of having that consultation with him, you know, he was looking at me and his eyes were widening. And I could see him, and this is one of my expressions, white knuckling it. You know when someone's gripping the chair and the knuckles go white? Well, mm-hmm. he was obviously yeah. sitting there whilst listening to my symptoms and going, oh, my God, it's one of them. She's one of them, and she was one of my patients. So he led me to his colleague because he wouldn't actually see me or treat me. I suppose that would have been for litigious reasons. I don't really understand why. And his colleague said to me, oh, I'll come into emergency tomorrow through the hospital and we'll have a look at what's going on. We'll do a urodynamic study. Now, every woman who's been down this road knows that that's a study where you pee in cups. And they measure, you know, the amount that you're leaking, the amount that you void, the amount that you get rid of, and how much you empty your bladder and so on. So, interestingly, I showed up without support because I was like, okay, well, let's have a look at what's really going on. Of course, I still trust these doctors at this stage. And he put me in a gown and anaesthetized my vagina. And I'm like, in my brain, I'm thinking, okay, what's going on here? I was supposed to be peeing in a cup. So I guess the really terrible part of this story is they knew what was going on and didn't let me know. So he said, okay, if a couple of the students come in, I'm thinking, yeah, I don't care. I understand teaching. I've had to do plenty of it in my life. So he puts a probe up my urethra and his face just drops. Now, as I said before, I had a surgeon as a stepfather, so they don't frighten me. And I looked at him and it just didn't compute. And then my meeting with the original implanting surgeon the day before started to drop into my brain. Now, at this stage, my brain was incredibly foggy, incredibly unwell, and very, very traumatized and terrified. And I looked at him and I thought, surgeon, poker face, what is going on here? So I hopped off the table and I reached for the screen and I turned the screen around. And the screen was awash with blue and white. And I was like, excuse my French, what the is that? And he just looked at me and he said, that's the mesh. Now, mesh didn't mean anything to me. I'd been living under, you know, living in bed in Bali, Indonesia, away from any sort of, you know, mainstream news media. My mental health wasn't in a great shape, so I wasn't on a lot of social media. I hadn't heard anything about mesh. I didn't even know what mesh was. I didn't even know what the blue and white was because I'd never been given true informed consent, which was this is what the product is of what we're putting in your body. So I had no idea what he meant. He left me in a gown for about 20 minutes sitting in a cold room. And my head just went into one of those warp speed, what on earth is going on? And I started to Google on my phone. And then he came in and he drew a picture. And what he told me was the mesh was skewering my urethra and was potentially causing a lot of damage in my vagina. And that he had no idea exactly how much that was or how bad it was. But his prognosis was that it needed to be removed. And he said he would try to remove it with multiple surgeries and a high probability of a catheter for the rest of my life. And I was 47 years old.
Oh, what a shock. Horrible.
Yeah. And it was terrible. It was like watching my whole life just unfold in those few minutes. Oh. You know, I was just in such shock. I had no idea what to do, so I did a beeline back to Bali. I'd spoken to one of my girlfriends who I'd been staying with in Sydney, and neither of us had any idea of the enormity of this. The surgeon did mutter class action, and that was really my entrance into it. And I found a Facebook group that I'm now one of the moderators of, and I found a whole bunch of women who were in the same boat. There was like over 1,000 women. I was like, okay, this is really a problem then, isn't it? And all of these women were having similar problems. This may not have migrated as mine did, and my American surgeon says that because it's malfitted. But they were still having the autoimmune problems, or they were in chronic pain like I was, and they couldn't walk. And they had all worked out what the problem was because they'd been following the media. So very, very quickly, this all started to become insanely overwhelming. And it took me quite a while before my brain was able to connect all of the dots. Like, okay, so they malfitted the implant. How do you get the implant out? Oh, the Australian surgeon says this way. Let me talk to the other women and see if there are any other Australian doctors. And you know, the consensus of opinion was that the Australian surgeons were way behind two of the American surgeons. So I did my math and I did my research and looked at the, you know, the intelligent women on the group who were nurses, paramedics and so on. And they were all going to, or had been, going to St. Louis to Dr. Dionysius Veronicus. So, you know, my mental health was absolutely in the toilet at this stage because I had been told by every single doctor that I had consulted that they couldn't find out what was wrong with me, had no idea why. They didn't think to ask had I had any, you know, medical implants and what my full surgical history was. And, you know, I got so overwhelmed by the odds that the Australian surgeon gave me before I found these women on the Facebook group, that one night on my own here when I was doing my research, I just, you know, I thought that was my only option. So I decided I no longer wanted to be a sick person, and I took a bunch of pills, a bunch of booze, and a bunch of knives and ran a hot bath and decided that I was going to put myself misery because I didn't want multiple surgeries. I didn't want to live as a sick person anymore, and I didn't want to be in this much pain. One of my girlfriends who must have sensed that, you know, my feelings were so low at that stage, actually came and kicked the door down, and, you know, the rest is history. I didn't achieve that. I went to spiritual death door, took one look at it all and went, okay, if I'm going to live, well, then I'm going to live well. So within 2 months of finding out what was the cause of my ill health, chronic pain and mental health issues, it was literally 2 months to the day, from the 14th of August 2017 when I found out about the implant being the cause, I was on Dr. Veronica's surgery table on the 14th of October. So somehow I traversed, you know, time zones, volcanoes, all kinds of things to be able to make that happen. I scrimped and saved, or used the scrimps and savings and, you know, borrowed money from friends and went to America, which was the sanest thing I could possibly have done, because the photographs of what he achieved by removing the device that had skewered my urethra in several places and embedded itself in my bladder, he was able to remove it and repair everything. And 2 weeks later, I was back on a plane to Sydney to some dear friends to convalesce. And, you know, that was when, you know, I made that absolute conscious choice of, you know, if I'm going to live, I'm going to live well here. So yeah, that's kind of the story of the implant.
Well, you know, what an amazing journey. So let me just clarify. So when they put that mesh implant, it was supposed to support your bladder. Is that what it does? It just gives it a...
It goes under the urethra, so that the urethra has to then, you know, go against gravity, and it just lifts it up and supports it so that you can't leak. That's the idea.
So what happens with this mesh, it's the material, first of all, whenever you're putting something in the body, you're at high risk of scar tissue developing around it because it's irritating the body, so the body's trying to protect itself. So it became embedded in scar tissue. But the material, what you're saying and what you found out, the material of this mesh device actually was having the body was reacting to it and creating these infections, an autoimmune response, this exhaustion, this fatigue, this destruction of your... It's like a foreign object that was in your body for all these years, and the body was trying to get rid of it and couldn't do it. So it was creating all sorts of reactions on all levels. I mean, it wasn't just physiological. It also affected your whole, you know, mental health as well.
Yep, wow. Absolutely. I mean, you know, I would never have believed it had I not have experienced it.
Yeah. Wow. So
after my surgery, I went and had lots of rounds of tests where they, you know, I was like, okay, now I need to re-engage with the medical system because I had disengaged. And I was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. I was diagnosed with thyroid disease. I already had the diagnosis of fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue. I mean, the list just went on. I mean, if you saw my blood test results and my health on paper, you would wonder how I was able to put one foot in front of the other. I mean, I've been diagnosed with pudendal neuralgia and nerve damage all down my right-hand side because my surgeon was probably left-handed. I think that's the way it goes. So, yeah, you know, like, I had more problems than Captain Cook, my dear friend, said when he arrived in Australia.
Well, so this is what happens when we put these foreign substances that are not inert. The body is reacting and is having all sorts of ramifications when it's perceived that there's this toxic substance in there, and it's just... further debilitates the body's ability to function, and that's for all these autoimmune conditions, and it's a whole downstream effect. So did these things clear up when you had that mesh removed?
They actually got worse. You know, that was the weirdest part of it for me. You know, like, you know, you kind of have this fantasy because you've been struggling, because I was struggling for so long, I had a fantasy that when it was removed, I'd be better within a few weeks. Now, on a physical level, I was a bit better because I could move differently. Like, I wasn't, you know, the crippling pain down my right side had been alleviated somewhat. You know, I could stand up straight, whereas I wasn't when my urethra was being skewered. You know, I couldn't stand up straight. I was bent over double with the pain. So, you know, there were certain things that were better straight away. I mean, you know, you could see my eyes started shining brighter. You know, things started coming back. My hair stopped falling out. You know, a whole range of stuff. And I think I started to absorb some vitamins, you know, and things like that, because my body wasn't just permanently attacking itself. However, a few months in, I remember just feeling worse and worse and thinking, what is going on here? And that's when I got the diagnosis of the diabetes, the thyroid disease. And yet the doctors were too terrified to treat me. I actually feel very grateful to one endocrinologist, because she looked at me and she said, I do actually believe that the mesh has caused these problems. And if I start medicating you, you're going to go down this road. You might want to wait and see if that shifts. However, waiting to see if it shifted wasn't helping the symptoms and wasn't helping me and feeling well and getting well. So a girlfriend of mine one day said to me, have you ever thought about fasting? And I looked at her and I went, I've lived in Indonesia. I've seen what happens to the Muslims when they go to Ramadan. They all go bonkers, you know, because they don't eat and drink in 40-degree heat. I said, what do you mean fasting? And she said, how about you Google Jason Fung and Michael Mosley and have a look at that, you know, in regards to your diabetes. And that changed my life. I started watching their YouTube, and I immediately stopped eating, because, of course, I was doing all the right thing. I was eating whole foods. I was having a green smoothie for breakfast, you know, an organic salad for lunch, and protein and vegetables for dinner. You know, I was on all the right, you know, health ideas, because I knew about health. I'd had two kids with special needs. I was gluten-free, you know, lactose-free. I was allergic to just about everything. So I had a very, you know, simple, highly nutritious diet. So I just stopped eating, and that is what absolutely changed the trajectory of my health and getting well again. Stopping eating, my brain fog started to lift, and I reversed the diagnosis of diabetes and thyroid disease within a year.
Wow, what a miracle to have found that on this journey that you've been on. So the fasting just gave your body a chance to stop, to heal, put this energy into repair rather than the digestive process, which is why
That's
fasting
right.
is so powerful. So that was the key
That's
for
right.
you. Wow.
Absolutely
that was
the
a miracle.
Key. I mean, I was still doing all these other things. It really was a miracle. I mean, I was still doing the intravenous vitamin C. I was still following protocols, you know, for health. I think I did ketogenic diet for the first year of the fasting. You know, I was, you know, totally off sugar. You know, I did all of the right things, not necessarily medically, but health-wise. And, you know, it took about a year of ingesting bone broth and, you know, lots of water, and totally changed how I thought about food. And allowing the body, and that's what you just said, which is spot on. When you take food out of the equation, the body then sends all of the energy to repairing your cells. You eat one meal a day. I intermittently fast every day. And, of course, I'd stacked on 25, 30 kilos because my body was in complete crisis during those mesh years. You know, it thought it was dying and starving and all the rest of it. So, you know, I lost that 25 kilos, and it really has given, you know, my body an opportunity to come back to wellness. I mean, the only thing I'm really battling now is a little bit of fatigue and the pudendal neuralgia in my right side. Aside from that, I have pretty much nailed every other, you know, medically diagnosed problem that I've had.
And you really appreciate how amazing the body is in its ability to heal and repair and regenerate when it's been through such a long period of abuse, basically,
right.
You know, destructive inner processes.
Absolutely.
Did that mesh dissolve or was it intact?
Well, I've got photographs and it was for the most part intact, but I took silica for a year and a half for any of the little bits that were left, but Dr. Veronicus has a good visual record of how much he was able to remove from it, and it looks like it was definitely the majority of it, because without
right.
that, and you know, the beauty of having surgery in the US is you get to sign the DNR, and I was like, if you can't get all of that out, my life isn't worth living.
Right. Right. Well, what a hero he was to have found someone who could
yes.
do this. Because
yes.
obviously it's a very specialized surgery to be able to go in and it's like everything is embedded in tissue and to be able to take it out without destroying
mm-hmm.
the tissue and without creating further damage is such a skill.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So, so Justine, what did you
and
learn?
And that's almost a nigh impossibility. Sorry.
Right. Right. Yeah. So he really is a miracle man. So out of this experience, you really became a crusader to help other women. And let's talk about what has emerged and one of your missions and purposes in life from this experience and how it's helping other women. And let's talk more about what's going on in the world with mesh and women.
Yeah, look, you know, for me, once this had landed, you know, I felt angry. It was like, hold on a minute. You know, how did this happen? And I take responsibility for the fact that I did not do my own due diligence, you know, and in that space, when I can say, you know what, I didn't. However, I've spoken to many women who did do their due diligence and still went through with the surgery. So there's no great difference between us. But for me, to deal with my anger, rather than staying in a position of victim around this whole problem, you know, victim to the surgeon, victim to Johnson & Johnson, victim to the TGA, the FDA, and all the people who approve these things, you know, I decided to speak out. And it has really helped me therapeutically to understand this subject and see where the gaps are, see where the corruption lies, see where you know, women have been duped and, you know, lulled into false senses of security, lied to, and, you know, so to get angry and to speak about it has been really good for my journey, because I do believe that whilst one stays in a position of victim, you know, one is not going to heal, and that was definitely the case for me. And,
right.
you know, I met a number of very, very sane intelligent women on this journey, and we clubbed together, three of us in particular, and, you know, we're permanently told by the health consumers and other health advocates in Australia that unless we formalised a union, you know, made a charity or a foundation, we would never be taken seriously. And so that's what we did. And my goal, you know, back in 2018 was to have this problem in the mainstream media in Australia. And thanks to the class action, which came to fruition in November last year, that happened. And so now, you know, this has been a household name. We've had it in big newspapers. There's been spreads in the big newspapers. There's been, you know, magazine articles, in the women's articles. And, you know, one of my passions is get informed. Don't have this surgery blindly like many of us did. You know, if you want to have surgery, absolutely. It is your human right and your choice. However, you are playing Russian roulette with your health, because I think around 30% of women, and these figures will be much more substantiated once the class action comes to fruition in Australia, because there were over 40,000, there was 150,000 kits sold in Australia. And over 80 of those were, 110 of those were Johnson & Johnson. So all of the women with those kits in them, the court mandated that there was to be a reach out. And so at some stage before sort of May this year or April this year, we should know the exact figures because the women are automatically part of the class action with the way that the Australian law works. So, yeah. Back to, you know, why did I do it? This has helped me.
Class action. I was going to say, Justine, if you have so many women that are part of the class action, that's going to be a huge settlement from Johnson & Johnson, I would imagine.
Well, that's right. Well, and don't ask me too much about class action because I don't really understand them. This would be historical. We have one. We won in November last year. The judge found that Johnson & Johnson were negligent in how they tested the products. They found that they didn't supply enough evidence around what were the side effects, potential side effects. There's a 1,500-page document from the court around corruption, around, you know, women's deaths being covered up. You know, there's a plethora of a labyrinth of yuck. And as I say, the numbers, the court has mandated that every woman who's ever had an implant has to be contacted because they are automatically part of the class action. And that has to happen by early April. So we should have a better understanding of numbers in Australia when that's complete. They did, just a few weeks ago, reach a settlement for the three lead complainants. One was 1.2 million, one was 700 and something thousand, another one was 555,000. And I did quite a bit of media around that, and my stance on that is not enough money to, let's use my case, that's not enough money to compensate me for the 10 years I've lost and for the future care I will need with the disability that I have acquired from, you know, this problem. So I think the government's going to have to stand up and is going to have to bridge the gap because we're, you know, there's a women out there so much worse than me in wheelchairs. You know, the husbands have left them because they can't have sex, because they can no longer fulfill their maternal or grandmotherly roles and their matrimonial roles. And, you know, there is a huge percentage of women out there who are still really unwell, haven't had removal, haven't been able to achieve what I have, and, you know, who are going to need lifelong care.
Well, it's, you know, there's such a long history, Justine, of women being medicalized and pathologized for profit.
Mm-hmm.
And I've certainly researched this for so many years, and this is just another chapter, a very sad chapter in how women have been abused. And what, you know, and what you found out is that the Johnson & Johnson lied about testing it and the safety of it, and it was all about money and doctors getting money, right, for promoting it and doing it. And they knew from the get-go that this was a dangerous product.
Well, you know, I like to believe well of humans. I can't believe that they didn't question it from the get-go. Hmm. You know, I find that incredible that they didn't question it from the get-go. And, you know, did they use it on their wives? You know, that's a great, you know, that's something that I would say to any doctor moving forward now is, you know, is this something you would do for your wife, daughter, mother? You know, and as you say, women have been abused, you know, since the beginning of time, femicide, you know, many of us were drowned and burnt at the stake and so on and so forth just for being women. You know, this is just another of the age-old story. However, whilst women affected by this remain victims, they're not going to get well. They're not going to come out of this, you know, and heal their bodies. You know, whilst they then sit and blame and so on, you know, we have to get out of the victim position here. And that is the only way to heal. And that is taking responsibility for your life, your body, for what's happened, and practicing absolute wellness, mind, body, and soul.
So, Justine, for all these women who had these implants and have been affected, and they have had autoimmune diseases and neuropathies and whatever else has gone on, for them to recover, I would imagine they need to have that mesh implant removed, or else they're just going to be, you know, suffering in different ways.
Sadly, for a very large percentage of women, their belief is they can't have it removed. Now, there are some women who whose implant has migrated and has been malfitted, and the implant sits on, you know, a particular nerve or a major blood vessel or an artery, and removing it would cause their instant death or permanent, you know, disability. Not everyone suffers the chronic inflammation and autoimmune problems. Some people suffer the pain just from the implant, which is, you know, I mean, you know, in what sane thought did you put something that was going to create, you know, all that scar tissue and become solid as a rock in a woman's pelvis? I mean, your pelvis is the most mobile part of your body. You know, and they're doing it with hernia mesh in men, you know, inguinal hernias and so on. The same is happening. So this isn't just transvaginal mesh. This is also other medical meshes. You know, meshes used in surgeries when people have had, you know, terrible accidents or car accidents, and, you know, the whole mesh is put in the stomach to keep all the organs in. You know,
yeah.
So this is medical mesh. This is going to be bigger than Ben-Hur eventually. They're going to have to find something else. You know, so some women can have it removed, some believe they can't, you know, and it takes a great level of skill. And there really are not many people in this world who can do what Dr. Veronica's and Dr. Raz have been able to do. And why they're not consulting with these two experts, you know, I call Dr. Veronica's the world leading expert. I believe Dr. Raz is retired, you know, but, you know, he has the knowledge. He has the skill. Why are we not reaching out to him? You know, you know, educating surgeons in other countries, you know, on how to do this with the minimal damage to the pelvis.
Is this mesh still being used around the world on women?
Yes.
Are there
the
other class actions
on the woman to understand the problems, really? Yeah, there's class actions all over the world. I mean, there's been over $8 billion paid out in mesh litigation since that figure was 2018 or 2019.
Wow. So the other question I want to ask is, what other alternative is available for women who have incontinence issues or prolapse issues, which the mesh has been the primary modality used, but what other options are there now for them?
Well, look, that's a great question, because when I had a meeting with the head urogynecologist of Australia and Australasia, there was a little bit of tension, and, you know, I did say to them, you know, well, there is another option. It's called native tissue repair. And you know, the response from the female doctor was, well, if you lot ban this, what am I going to teach my new up-and-coming urogynecologist? And I refrain from saying surgical skills. But she was very, you know, if you take this away, what are we going to do? And it's like, well, you will have to go back to the old-fashioned way. I mean, you know, the Sydney Morning Herald did a great article on this in their Good Weekend magazine. And, you know, they found that doctors boasted about the 8 minutes that it took. Hospital waiting times were massively reduced. You know, everybody benefited from this surgery, except, you know, at least a third of the women. And, you know, the reality is there is native tissue repair. It doesn't take 8 minutes. It takes a couple of hours or more. I'm not a surgeon. And it takes a level of skill. But I think, you know, we need to be training our new surgeons in that skill again, because, you know, taking a 30% risk on ruining your physical and mental health for the rest of your life too great a risk just for money. The reality is this is going to cost government, insurance companies, you know, the courts, the, you know, it's cost a lot of money to keep all of these women who have been permanently injured in lifelong care for the rest of their lives. It's ruining families, it's ruining people, it's ruining communities. It's an absolute disgrace.
You know, I can't imagine after paying out $8 billion how they can continue to keep this on, you know, in the marketplace and have and continue to do surgeries with it.
Well, it's the power of the dollar and the pharmaceutical industry. I mean, the Bleeding Edge documentary is one of the best examples of this. You know, the medical device industry is way bigger than the pharmaceutical industry, and the average person simply doesn't know that.
No, I didn't know that. I don't think most people do understand the medical device. What's included in the category of medical device?
Well, you've got life-saving things like stents and pacemakers and, you know, and then you've got things like hip replacements that, you know, really assist people to live better lives. But, you know, on the Bleeding Edge, that wonderful orthopedic surgeon who had a cobalt hip replacement who had a psychotic episode in a hotel room, I mean, he's a great example of why you do your research into, you know, what is the material that they are putting in your body, and if you have, you know, anecdotally, I ran a hotline for people who'd recently, you know, found out that they were potentially injured by mesh or wondered if they were. You know, they would watch the media and go, oh my God, one of those implants, and I would run the hotline, and I would, you know, out of my own interest ask, so tell me, as a child, did you have glandular fever? Have you had an autoimmune problem? Have you had cancer, leukemia, whatever? Every single person who talked to me about having autoimmune problems with the mesh had an already compromised immune system from when they were younger, somehow. And
right.
So those are the people who shouldn't be having these implants. They shouldn't have any foreign body put in their body.
Right.
It's just not, you know, and this is where the testing wasn't done properly, accurate, and there were no longitudinal studies. So it really is playing Russian roulette with your life, putting something foreign in your body, as you said before.
Well, so they were already vulnerable and were never never scanned for those vulnerabilities. It was never even the thought of getting their history on this before it was introduced as a possibility.
Well, as I say, it's anecdotal, but potentially, yes.
Right. So what are you advising the women who choose not to have implants removed and are exhibiting a variety of symptoms? What do you recommend to them, Justine? What kind of help is available for them to reduce their suffering and their pain and their symptoms?
Well, you know, we have reasonably decent, excuse me, pain management services in Australia. You know, that is one avenue. I mean, mental health is of primary importance. You know, I have managed chronic pain, you know, using meditation, you know, using looking after my nervous system. Looking after my nervous system has been my number one priority. You know, my metabolic health has been high up. So everything that I put in my body now serves a purpose to keep me well. And it's about, you know, doing research. And it doesn't have to be exorbitantly expensive. You know, fasting is cheap. That's why it's not particularly fashionable. No one can sell you anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've used papaya leaf tea to restructure my gut. That costs nothing. You get the leaf off the tree and you dry it out, you chop it up and you make tea from it. So, you know, I have on my blog, Journey to Recovery, you know, I've used turmeric. I grind turmeric and make it into a drink. You know, that's a great anti-inflammatory. So there are dozens and dozens of things that one can do if one doesn't choose to go down the road of removal. And I can understand why some women wouldn't, because you would be terrified to engage in medical treatment once again when you've been dismissed, denied, and told you're crazy. However, looking after your mental health and your physical health has to be of paramount importance.
Absolutely. You know, if you're dealing with conditions, you have to support the body as best you can, and especially if you choose not to follow through and have that mesh removed, then the body absolutely needs to have support, which means you have to make choices with your food and with the ongoing nutraceuticals or other modalities that are going to give the body the kind of support it needs so it can function under duress, right, under the stress. Mm. So tell us about your organization. Tell us where women can go to get support, to learn more, to be part, if that's still appropriate, of a class action suit, and in Australia and in other parts of the world as well.
Well, our organisation is called Mesh Injured Australia. Facebook groups, the Facebook page is Mesh Injured Australia. The Facebook groups that we run are Australian Mesh Injured Support Group. You know, all of these, if you put it in Google, it all jumps up at you, which is great. Shine Lawyers are the people who are running the class action for women with Johnson & Johnson mesh, and I do believe there's one other mesh that they are representing now. Some people aren't on Facebook, so that makes it a little bit, you know, more difficult, but I would highly recommend that you just open a Facebook account purely to be, you know, part of that and to be with other people in the same boat, because without those other women who had walked more of this journey before I arrived, you know, I wouldn't have found out what I did, and I wouldn't have been, you know, wouldn't have gone to Dr. Veronica's and wouldn't be in the good shape that I'm in now. So, you know, I will be eternally grateful for the women who championed this before we came along.
Absolutely. And, you know, it is honoring those women who have, like you, have gone through so much suffering to arrive at the place where you can turn around and help others because of all that you have learned along the way. It's, you know, you're the heroines in my reality, because there's so much that you had to endure to get to the place where you're being of such service to others now. So, you know, what can I say, Justine? I just, you know, in awe of you and what you've done and the passion you have and the difference you're making in the world. And I'm so glad to hear you're feeling better and taking care and being able to live a life again. You know, that's just such a, you know, a miracle in itself, having gone through everything you've gone through.
Yeah, thank you. And I couldn't have done it without Andrea and our other Kim, who I, you know, the three of us setting up Mesh Injured Australia and, you know, lobbying government, trying to bring awareness to this issue, you know, pushing stuff in the media. Without Andrea's support, you know, I wouldn't have been able to do what I do. I mean, I'm sort of the person that you see, but she's the woman behind all of this. She's the wife behind all of this who makes all of this happen. So I'm eternally grateful for her and you know, and the wonderful bond that we now have, you know, over such a terrible issue. You know, and I would love to see, you know, a lot more support for this issue. I would like to see women empowering themselves more and moving out of the victim position here, because it is the only way through this, is self-care, self-love, and, you know, to believe that there is another option available to them, because there is. I'm proof of that.
And just the last question I have before we come to the end of our conversation, what is it that you are doing now, Justine? What's your mission now? What are you involved with?
Well, I still have my counselling practice. I'm still consulting to the RPA to help create, you know, a good space. That is, I'm winding that up. And I'm moving much more into leadership consciousness and how to raise the vibration of the body and how to self-heal. So I'm working on a book at the moment and working with other groups of people to bring about a conversation that says the body is a self-healing organism, and how do we support that for people who have had chronic illness. So, yeah, I'm getting back into my life and my career, which is an absolute relief to be able to feel well enough to do that. And, I'm just really grateful, you know, for the fact that I can do that now. And having these conversations and women like you empowering other women by being able to tell the story, you know, I know how many women I have helped and who haven't had this surgery as a consequence of listening to my story or reaching out to me. And, you know, I feel so grateful to have been part of that. So thank you very much for having me on today. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Well, it's such an honor to have you on. And another example of, you know, the empowerment of women, someone who's gone through such a crisis in one's life and you chose to turn it around, find a mission, be able to support and assist so many other people. That's you know, really finding our power and making a difference in the world. So, Justine Watson, I am so grateful for you, for the wonderful work you're doing, and for the time you've given us today to share your inspiring story. So just wishing you all the best in all ways.
Thank you so much. I really do appreciate it. It's been a pleasure.
And to all of you listening, thank you for joining me. Please share this story. It's so powerful and so important that women have access to this knowledge and know that there are ways to stay healthy, get healthy, and become more aware and empowered in the process as well. So until next time, I just want to remind you to always honor the wisdom of your feminine self, and bye for now. Oh,